Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of The Awesome with Cody. I am Cody. This week is the beginning of a new month and a new theme. That theme, which I talked about last week, is time travel movies. So for the people who didn't listen to last week's episode or are new to the show, I am going to do time travel movies that I'm not going to say are lesser known, but they're not the most popular ones. Like, I'm not doing Back to the Future or Time Cop or Terminator, any of those ones. I'm going to do just a handful of time travel movies that I think are pretty awesome. And a couple of them you might have heard of before. This first one, which I told everyone I was watching last week, so if you wanted to watch it ahead of time, you could. And the reason I told you that, not that I told you last week, is this movie can be very confusing, and I'm going to break it down for you, which will still make it very confusing. We'll get to it. But anyways, so this week's episode is about Primer. Movie came out in 2004. It's an independent movie. Very low budget. It was shot for $7,000. It made a huge amount of money, $841,926. That was the box office. That's a pretty good return on investment, if you ask me. I'm no mathematician. But when you make, you know, $830,000 from spending $7,000 in a couple, months of your life, it's a pretty good return, I would say. So this movie was written, directed, produced, and starring a gentleman by the name of Seth Carith, I think it's how you pronounce it, Shane Carruth. I don't know how to say his last name. He's made a couple different movies, mostly independent stuff. He's directed a few. He's been an actor in a handful of independent movies. He's won been nominated for a bunch of awards. He's only won a few. Won a bunch for Primer, which is pretty cool because the movie's pretty dope. His other movie, Upstream Color, I have not seen yet, but I will go and watch it as well eventually. He plays the main, one of the main characters, along with David Sullivan, who plays the other main character. David Sullivan, no, he's not related to me, for the people who know. He's been in a handful of movies. He's been in a bunch of TV shows. His most popular or most well-known role, I guess you could say, is he plays a character named Dennis on the show Flaked on Netflix Will Arnett. Yeah, I was right. Oh man, I was about to doubt myself. Will Arnett. He plays the other main character. Like, it's all about Flaked is all about Will Arnett's character, but his best friend, in a way, is played by David Sullivan. The character's name is Dennis, and he's the best friend and co-star of this movie, along with Shane's character. But that's really, I mean, otherwise the cast is literally five people long, or six people long. One, two, three, four, five, six. Oh, seven if you count the other. I mean, I guess Will counts too. Those two are the only ones that are really have done anything else. The rest are just like we're friends and things along the line or along with everybody else going to go along with the movie. So that's how he kind of kept the price to $7,000, because he essentially, you know, made the movie with his friends. Didn't pay a lot of money to actors. So again, made a lot of money. So, you know, that's good for him. The movie starts off. So Shane's character, Aaron, and Abe, who's played by David, are two engineers who supplement their day jobs with entrepreneurial tech projects, working out of Aaron's garage. So there you go. So the first one of the where it comes, where the time travel comes in, is here. During one of the experiments, they're trying to use electromagnetics to reduce the weight of objects. They accidentally stumble upon a A to B time loop side effect. So basically, an object left within the field, or A, travels through time for a certain amount of time, as long as it is in that field until B, when the field is turned off, ending the loop. So it's a time loop. Basically, it goes starts at A, and then B as it comes back around. So there's a whole cycle. But if you stop it properly, you can actually get out at the right time, and there will be actually two of you, the future you and the current version of you. And the only thing you have to do, make sure you get back in the box at the right time. So when you come out of it at B, you are essentially back where you started. And so that sounds confusing because the way it's done. So then back from B to A, and it continues repeating loop because it goes from A to B and then B to A as it loops back around, right? All right, so they designed this box that's part of the original experiment for the electromagnetic reduction of weight. And they make different alterations to it, and they figure out how to make it run. And they end up finding that the box is actually will self-power itself after a little while. So they can disconnect it from power, which means they can let it running, keep it running without draining a power source. Because of the field that it generates, and it actually winds itself up and winds itself down. So, they go from there, and then, the interesting thing about the movie is there's this voiceover that is one of the characters, and it's really hard to tell who it is. So during this, there's this explaining of the process they're going through and the kind of like a warning of what's going to happen. So Abe refines the proof of concept and builds a stable time, apparatus or the box, basically big enough for a human subject to go into. He then uses the box to travel 6 hours into his own past as part of the process. The original Abe sits in a hotel room away from everybody, so they interact with each other. While the future of the original Abe, then we'll enter the box, awaits inside the box for 6 hours, thus going back in time for 6 hours, and becomes future Abe, who travels across town, explains the procedure to Aaron, who then brings Aaron back to the self-storage facility where he has the new human-sized box located, and basically explains the whole thing at the end of the time lap. So original Abe enters the box and ceases to exist. So then there's only future Abe left. They watch him go into it. So then they come up with this plan to make money using this. So Abe and Aaron repeat Abe's 6-hour experiment multiple times over multiple days, making profitable same-day stock trades armed with foreknowledge from the market's future and their performance. They then there's some shifting of basically relationship between the two. Abe starts becoming cautious and controlling, and Aaron is impulsive and meddlesome. He's starting to do things outside the original plan, betting or going bigger on the stock exchange, the stock stuff, altering things and how things work out, because he knows where people are going to be at in certain times. Then there's so basically they go through, there's some personal tensions between not only the two of them, because they're kind of butting heads on there, but there's some other stuff going on with the family members throughout this. So one of the ones that is happens, and it's a very interesting thing, is there's a part where they're driving from Aaron's house. I'm trying to remember this correctly, because Abe gets woken up by a kid who's hitting alarms on cars as he's skateboarding down the street. So he comes to him with this this plan to basically extend the time that they're in the box to basically help him with this, basically being awake at a certain time. So basically what happens is there's some tension comes when they encounter Thomas Granger, who is the father of Abe's girlfriend, Rachel, who appears inexpectedly unshaven and exists in an overlap, I'm reading off of a description of it, with the original suburban self, with his original suburban self. Granger falls into a comatose state after being pursued by Aaron. Aaron theorizes that the same unknown points in the future, Granger enters the box with the timeline altering consequences. Abe concludes that the time travel is simply too dangerous and enters a secret secret second box, the failsafe box, as he calls it, built before the experiment began and kept continuously running, traveling back 4 days to prevent the experiment's launch. I know that's really confusing. So basically, the father of Abe's girlfriend somehow follows them because he sees them at one point, follows him to the storage facility, gets in the box himself, causing the break between his reality and his future, ends up running into himself, going a little bit insane, and then falling into a comatose state, which I'm going to guess happens if you are shocked all of a sudden that you're seeing yourself. So from there, so Abe tries to go back and essentially stop the experiments from happening. The whole timelines start to run havoc as future Abe sedates original Abe, so he never can never conduct the initial time travel experiment. Meets original Aaron in the park bench to dissuade him from doing it, but finds out that future Aaron has gotten there first, armed with the pre-recording of the past conversation and unobtrusively. Basically, an earpiece, and basically has found a way to disassemble the third failsafe box 4 days back with his original, with his own body. Future Abe then he faints at the realization, overcome by the shock and fatigue, because he went 4 days back and has kind of run a havoc on him because he's essentially asleep for 4 days and has to come out of it, and he's been run ragged. So he finds out that Aaron had found out about the failsafe box and decided to go back in that failsafe box to stop Abe from being able to stop him from getting him part of the experiment. Yeah, so craziness. But then the two men briefly reconcile because of because of an event that happens. So they jointly travel back in time, experiencing and reshaping an event where Abe's girlfriend Rachel was nearly killed by gun wielder at a party crasher, and then because of this, the future knowledge that Aaron knows, he knows the events is going to happen, so he actually stops the gunman and becomes a local hero, and then basically Abe and him then kind of butt heads again. They ultimately part ways. Aaron considers a new life in a foreign country where he can tamper with more, basically more stocks and other ways to basically get personal gain, while Abe states that his intent is to remain in town and dissuade, sabotage the original box experiment, causing both of them to obviously be null and void. So future versions of being null and void. So Abe warns Aaron to leave town and never return. So that's kind of the end of the movie. The epilogue is revealed that multiple box aware versions of Aaron are still alive and circulating because he has sent himself back to get in the machine multiple times outside of the 6-hour loop that Abe thinks they're in. So there's multiples of them running around doing different things, helping each other gain more wealth for the future version of them, who helps the original Aaron through discussions, the voice recordings, and an unsuccessful physical alteration, which is, I believe, is supposed to be the altercation with the father of Abe's girlfriend, Thomas. I know it's very confusing. Then the future Abe watches the original Abe going painstakingly extremes to keep him unaware of the future, so there's not a crash in the loop, much like what Aaron did to himself, and then because he's afraid that he may not be able to have multiple Aarons or multiple Abes like Aaron has, so he tries to basically keep him. He wants to keep going with it, so he makes the money, but not be super crazy like Aaron was. And then the final scene is depicted where Aaron, who is fully aware of everything, so fully aware Aaron is basically the future, the most futurist version of Aaron, I think is what they mean by this, is seen talking to a bunch of workers who are basically helping him construct a warehouse-sized box where he'll be able to put in, I don't know if it's going to be multiple people or vehicles or something else in there to even travel back with him to whatever, however long he goes back into it. So that's Primer. It's a very confusing movie. It's basically this. The two of them, Abe thinks that he's kind of ahead in the game, but Aaron is actually manipulating him once he finds out the time loop and uses that to his advantage to get ahead of Abe who's eventually going to try to stop him from doing what he's doing. And then he goes and does what he wants anyways. And Abe is basically good with just keeping himself in that same loop. So yeah, very confusing movie, but very interesting and very fun movie, and very interesting to watch. There's this picture I found, this infograph that explains the time loop a little better than I probably did in more simpler terms, in a way that I'll post with the show, with when I post the show up on the Facebook page. But yeah, that's it. Pretty interesting movie if you like those time travel conundrum movies. But yeah, that's it for Primer. And again, as I talked about last week, I'm going to add a new segment to each of the shows coming up real quick at the end of each one, kind of break down, going to give you guys a glimpse of what I've been reading lately. Someone said I should also talk about what I've been watching lately, but I don't think that's a good one. I may add it later. We'll see how the what I'm reading goes, how it goes from now on. I'm always reading something, either comic books or novels. This week's episode, I'm going to talk about two novels. Oddly enough, both by Stephen King, and neither of them have to do with time travel. So I don't know why I said oddly enough, but they're both by Stephen King. The first one that I'm going to talk about is Dr. Sleep. Dr. Sleep is a sequel to The Shining, also by Stephen King. The book, not the movie, because there's differences in what happens in them. So Dr. Sleep basically sees a grown-up Danny Torrance, who was the little boy from The Shining, basically being a dysfunctional adult. He is an alcoholic. He's a substance abuser. He is trying to basically find a way to control The Shining, as it is known, because he's being haunted by these leftovers or ghosts from the Overlook Hotel. And he basically works with Dick Halloran, who's a character originally from The Shining as well, who also has a little bit of Shining, to use this trick where he basically locks the ghosts in this mental box that they can't get away. So he does that successfully as a younger man, and being able to kind of keep that going. But he uses alcohol to deaden the Shining because it makes his brain work less and makes his abilities less usable. So that was pretty cool the way they did it. So the whole story of this one is you meet Danny as he's in his early 20s, I believe. The book jumps in time quite a bit, a bunch of years at a time, and he's on the skids. He's living paycheck to paycheck, barely. He wakes up in a woman's house or apartment, both naked. Obviously, they fooled around a little bit. He gets slight glimpses of the night before, but very trashed. There's an interaction there where Tracy sneaks out where she's passed out, ends up stealing money out of her purse, finds out that she has a kid, an infant, an infant toddler, I should say, who almost gets into some cocaine that they left out from the party from the night before, and he ends up bringing him into the room, and then that thought process of that keeps basically... The Shining keeps haunting that imagery keeps haunting him throughout there. And so eventually, delves back in the alcohol and then leaves town, goes to different places. And he keeps having these visions of, this girl, Denny, and the baby. And then, he ends up basically arriving in this small town, where he, because basically befriends this guy who works at this tourist trappy thing there. It's this little miniature town that of made up that basically has this big train set, which they kind of bond over, and he ends up getting this guy gets him work, he starts a new life in this new town. Then you jump to this baby girl was born in 2001, named Abra Stone, who, basically manifests the psychic powers just like Danny the Shining, who, seemingly predicts the events of September 11th terrorist attacks, but she's an infant, so she can't talk. So she basically manipulates her parents to having dreams, trying to show them what she's seeing, because she has an understanding of it. She's just very upset because of the death and stuff that's going on. Lena, you need to know that she has a shining. She's very powerful in it. And then she stumbles upon the radar of these essentially vampires who are known as the True Knot. The True Knot are these not completely immortal, but basically forever living creatures who suck up steam to keep youthful and young, and they all have certain abilities and all tapped into the shine in a certain way, in different ways, as you find out in this book that there's different variations of it. Some people have it, some people can control it, some people can't control it. And then the steam comes from young kids who are tapped into the shine as well, who they can then torture to death. As they do this, it releases more steam. They can feed off of it, become younger, and stay, you know, active and stuff like that. Pretty crazy, I know, but it's Stephen King, so there you go. Eventually, Abra, as a young girl, communicates with Dan Torrance, through the shine in different ways. First, writing a chalkboard that's off in his room when he starts, starts working at this hospice. And helping patients kind of pass peacefully when it's their time. And he gets this nickname called Dr. Sleep. That's where the book title comes from. So they start communicating, and then they slowly, she's worried because she starts getting glimpses of this True Knot who they killed, this, as she refers to as baseball boy, in a terrible way. And she can't escape that thought or that vision. Just like Danny has a problem escaping some of his visions. Then they basically work work it out together to figure out who they are and see if they can stop them. And then it goes on from there to do that. It's pretty cool book, and a pretty cool way to tie it into The Shining in a way. There's some other stuff in there too that if I'm not going to ruin for you, you can read the books and read the book. I recommend reading both books. It does play about into it, because you get to see like father, like son, because of his father, Danny's father's Jack, his legacy of anger and alcoholism are ripe with Danny when he gets older too. So there's kind of a mirroring of that. And it's him struggling not to be like his father, which is pretty cool. Cause it's, you know, it's a big thing. You know, if it runs in the family traits and all, So that's Dr. Sleep. That's the first Stephen King book I read. That one came out 5 years ago. Very long book too. It's like 500 something pages. It's pretty lengthy. But a really good read. It's really interesting. Stephen King has this really creepy way of really getting you invested in characters in ways that is stupendous, and he does that very good job in this one too, just like he did in The Shining. So it's pretty cool that way too. Plus, it's you get to kind of see where Danny went afterwards, which is a big thing why he wrote this book, because Danny Torrance kept popping up in his brain, and he's like wanting to, hey, I wonder, because people would ask him like whatever happened to Danny after that events, and then eventually he wrote the book. So that's where that came from. The next one is a brand new book from Stephen King that just came out in May, a couple weeks ago. Actually, was that a week ago? Was that when that came out? I'd say 2 weeks ago now. It's the 5th today, which means 6th is when you guys hear this. Yeah, this was like 2 weeks ago. It's called The Outsider. It's cool because there's this link between the a series of books he did before, called the Bill Hodges books, or Bill Hodges novels or stories, whatever you want to call it. Started off with a detective, but it started off with the book Mr. Mercedes, which was then made into a TV show, which is pretty awesome. I think they did a really good job with the TV show, but I'll talk about that another time, when I come to adaptations. But they bring a character in from that, which is pretty cool too. So basically, without spoiling anything in the story, it's really cool. It's a really interesting story, and it's very confusing at the beginning because, you know, with Stephen King, for the most part, there's going to be some supernatural stuff going on, but it takes a really long time for you to get to the point where you know what kind of supernatural stuff's going on. But he gives, like, there's a once you figure out it out, you, I mean, it, everything falls into pieces, or all the pieces fall in, and you see the whole puzzle, as they say, very quickly once you find out what's going on. But basically it's this. So the main character in this book, his name is Ralph. He's a detective, police detective in a small town called Flint City in Oklahoma, which is a fictional town, by the way, so don't like look up Flint City. Just like most of the main cities that Stephen King focuses on. Basically, Ralph Anderson. Oh, excuse me. He basically goes to arrest a popular teacher and Little League coach by the name of Terry Maitland in front of a crowd of people at a baseball game, which is the semifinals, I think is what it is, if I remember correctly. Charging him with the raping, the killing, and the mutilating of an 11-year-old boy. So Maitland, who insists he's innocent, but Anderson has eyewitnesses and clear physical evidence, DNA and fingerprints, to prove his guilt. So right then and there, you're like, oh, that seems like that's, you know, what happens. A bad guy believes, you know, tries to plead innocent. This is where it gets crazy. So turns out that Maitland's alibi is that he wasn't in town. He was in Cap City, the next city over, which is about 70 miles away, so not a quick jaunt over. But he's with a bunch of other people who corroborate the fact that he's there. Plus, he's on camera footage, security footage, as well as television footage of him at a conference for English teachers, which he is an English teacher, as well as a Little League baseball coach, during a guest panel of a writer, who one of his favorite writers, and so he's seen on camera, that's dated and seen by multiple people, saying that he was in Cap City at the time the events happened, where he was actually being seen by these eyewitnesses in Flint City after the crime was committed. So it's crazy how that happens. And then I'll get to the point where like I'll stop, basically. So after all this mountain evidence on both sides, Anderson starts to kind of like, he can't figure out what it is. So basically during the arraignment, basically bringing Maitland to the arraignment at the courthouse, he is confronted by the older brother of the victim and shot dead on the in the street by this kid, who's a 17-year-old kid whose brother was I'll explain the murder in a minute, and it's fucking terrible, first off. Overstraught, but also added on to the fact that the mother of the victim and this older boy end up suffering a heart attack because of in grief and not taking very good care of herself. She ends up dying of a heart attack, causing more stress on both the son, the remaining son, and the father. During the shooting, Anderson shoots the older brother dead after unfortunately missing the first shot, which could have saved Terry Maitland's life, but he didn't get it off properly because he got bumped and the bullet went awry. Second shot killed the kid, so now he's killed a kid. His what he thinks is a complete, you know, coffin nail shut case against this guy who has this alibi, is shot dead, and so the case is essentially null and void. So then it goes on from there. I'm not going to go any further because that's where it starts to get really, really good from that part, because once you get past the craziness, it just more craziness starts to unfold after that. And then it's cool because you hear like the interviews from the eyewitnesses, and you start getting all these different feelings. I have all these different ideas. Like, is it time travel? Is it two of them? Is it something where he faked his alibi in a way where he was actually there, but it was at a different time? Like, I had all these theories. What it was, I was incorrect about what it was. So that's on me. Excellent book. I just finished it today. Great characters in it, great twists and turns. And once you kind of get to the supernatural stuff and it starts all going in one direction, it's pretty much straightforward, just straight shot to the end of the book. There's some stuff that happens in there that kind of, you know, maneuvers through back line to line on there, but no twists and turns really once you get to the supernatural stuff. So what really got me on this book is the horrific death of this 11-year-old boy. He's not the only victim in this book. You don't get to hear about the other ones, but you kind of get a sense that they're pretty terrible as well. But what really threw me with this one is I'm hoping Stephen King didn't come up with this death. Like, maybe it was an amalgamation of different ones because he's made a lot of contacts throughout the years. I'm just hoping this didn't happen to one person ever in real life. And I hope it was just like all these different weird things that Stephen King kind of put together. But anyways, so this 11-year-old boy was seen with a broken bike chain on his bike, meeting up with Terry Maitland, who sees him in a parking lot, witnessed by somebody, helping the boy put the bicycle with the broken chain in the back of a nondescript white van, then getting in with Maitland, and hasn't been seen since. Well, it turns out they found the body in this clearing of woods still in town, where the little boy was stripped naked. He was sodomized with a tree branch, sodomized like in the anus with a tree branch, so hard that blood splatters everywhere. But also the person who was doing it, was doing it so hard he scraped the bark off where his hand was being held. Then the boy's throat, right shoulder, and left earlobe were all removed. Looked like they were bitten off, like chewed off, by what they think is a human. And then the perpetrator then ejaculated all over the back, the buttocks, and the back of the legs of the child as he laid dying from blood loss and a terrible, terrible, terrible branch in a wrong place. It is a horrific crime to think of. And because of that crime is what actually sends Ralph over the edge, because Terry Maitland was actually a little league coach, but he coached Ralph's son back in the day. And so he feels like, because there's so much mounting evidence, that he feels slighted, that he was once friends with this guy who could do something so terrible to a kid. And so he makes some mistakes, arrests him in public, very publicly, in front of many people, and actually never questioned him ahead of time to get his alibi. So then the alibi comes to light after he's already been arrested, and that's when Ralph starts to see that his case isn't as solid as he has because there's conflicting evidence going towards this. So pretty interesting way of doing it. And it's a very, very good book. I burned through it in 2 weeks. So, yeah, you know, less than 2 weeks technically. Because I didn't start it on the 22nd when it came out. I bought it on the 22nd, but I didn't start it for a couple days because I was finishing Running Man, which I talked about a couple weeks ago on here. But anyways, that's it for what I've been reading. I'm going to try to do one or two things. I usually read one novel and a bunch of comic books each week, kind of give you guys an idea. They have nothing to do with the topic of the month. It's just more stuff for me to talk about on my show. And that's it for this week's episode. Next week's episode, if you guys want to watch the movie ahead of time, the movie I'm going to be watching is Looper, written and directed by Rian Johnson, who some people don't like anymore because of his Star Wars movie, but I'm not one of those people. And starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis, who play the same character. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. Otherwise, I'll be talking about it next week, and you can hear me gab about it. So that's it for this week's episode, everybody. Thanks for listening. As usual, let's be awesome.